This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Esther Patt, and we're talking about the joy of social ethics and politics. Welcome, Esther.
Thank you.
And how did you get interested in politics to start with? What intrigued you about it?
Well, very much to start with was when I was growing up. My family was very politically aware, and talking about politics at the dinner table was not something unusual at all. And my brother and sister were involved in the Independent Voters of Illinois Independent Precinct Organization. We lived in Chicago then, working valiantly against the Chicago machine because it was dishonest and unethical and racist and a lot of other things. And so I was I had just an orientation to the importance of individuals taking action to try to make change to improve their community and make the world a better place.
And how old were you when you got involved personally in doing something active in politics?
Well, other than going to some rallies and things, which I did in high school, I did try a little bit of door-to-door work for a candidate when I was in high school because my brother asked me to. But it was really my junior year in college when my first presidential election, where I was old enough to vote, came up, and I volunteered for a candidate in the Democratic primary who did not win, but I thought he was really good and he was strong on the issues I cared about. And it felt good to at least try to get the result that that would reflect my beliefs and my values.
Where did you go to college?
Here at the U of I.
What did you study?
I majored in English.
And following that presidential campaign, what did you do next politically?
Actually, that one little involvement just led into one thing, which just led into another. After that, in the campaign, I met Mary Pollock, who was a Champaign City Council member, and had an idea for us to have a big voter registration drive, which would be expected in the presidential year, and try to register students to vote so that we could then get them to vote in the city elections the following spring and elect people who were strong on issues students cared about, like tenants' rights. So I volunteered in the voter registration drive and ended up being the president of it, largely because I lived here in the summers and the other students left in the summer. And then from that, I got involved in the tenant union because I had developed this interest in tenant issues. And then after that, got involved in the Equal Rights Amendment Coalition because their office had been just down the hall, and I started talking with those folks. And I thought, well, I support equal rights. I'm a feminist. I should do this. And it just kept going and going and going that way.
And for listeners outside the Champaign-Urbana area who may not know, Esther Patt had an elected position on the Urbana City Council for 11 years up until 2005. So you eventually ran for office yourself. Tell us how that happened.
Well, I had been initially, primarily because of my interest in tenant rights issues, I had been volunteering for candidates for city council in every election, actually in Urbana and Champaign, and it was important to me to elect people who cared about tenants, who are actually more than half the population of each of our two cities, Champaign and Urbana. In 1993, I worked very hard for Joan Barr, who was an incumbent. We got her reelected, and then she resigned after a few months after being elected for health reasons. And at that point, there really was – I didn't have the same opportunity I did in elections to try to find a person who supported tenants' rights and then help get them elected. And the only way I felt confident I could get someone who would have the stance on issues I cared about was to step forward and do it myself. So I asked the mayor to appoint me, and there was a lot of support for appointing me since I had done so much of Joan Barr's door-to-door work for her, and he appointed me. And then a year later, I ran for election and then ran twice more for re-election.
Who was the mayor then?
That was Todd Satterthwaite.
Okay.
And he was the new mayor. He had just won in a very close election in 1993 where more people voted than ever had before in a municipal election, and he won by 53 votes out of more than 6,000 cast.
Wow.
Which I mention just because a lot of times people think, oh, what difference does it make when you work in elections? And, you know, sometimes if your candidate loses by 3,000 votes or wins by 3,000, then maybe it doesn't matter. But there are elections where actually the elections where candidates win or lose just by one vote.
Sure.
And you don't always know coming in which one it's going to be. But quite often individuals can say, if I personally had not been involved in this campaign, it would have gone the other way.
Now, you suggested the topic for this hour's discussion of using the word joy, the joy of social ethics and politics. You've been involved in national campaigns and local campaigns, regional campaigns. Which is the most fun?
Oh, well, the most fun is winning, of course. It doesn't really matter which it is. But it depends. As far as electoral work, actually what I find probably most fun is working on ballot questions and on referenda. Not that I don't like working for candidates, but the fun thing about ballot issues is that you don't get into partisan concerns, whether someone's Democrat or Republican or Green or Libertarian or whatever. And there's no baggage, you know, that comes with how people feel about the candidate as a person or their history or whatever. It's really just the issue, the idea. And that's kind of I actually find that the most fun for campaign work.
A lot of people looking at politics from the outside see so much negative things. And of course, I guess from Mark Twain's time onward, comedians have humorous have lambasted politicians as a class, as being immoral, as only doing what the party says or what's in their own interest. Have you found that true?
Well, I think in general, if you look at the whole world, it's really easy to see that, gosh, there's so much bad and there's so much evil and everything's all messed up. And that's sort of the reason I think that people are motivated to be politically active, to try to do something about that. And so, you know, with elected officials, a whole lot of elected officials are no good. A whole lot of candidates are no good. So some people just throw up their hands and say, oh, well, they're all bad. And, of course, it's very rare that if ever, it probably is never true that there's anything that's true of all whatever group of people or you know, anything. Everybody's different. Everything is different. And I think that what draws people to becoming involved in political work that involves candidates and elections is the hope and the opportunity to elect good people. And there are good people in the U.S. House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate, and there are good people in the local city councils, and there are good people in all the different levels of government in between, and there also are bad ones too. And of course, what you consider good or bad depends on the person. I mean, the people I think are good, others think are bad, and vice versa.
We're talking with Esther Patt on Keeping the Faith this afternoon, a former Urbana City Council member for 11 years, and her profession is being coordinator of the University of Illinois Tenant Union. We'll talk some more about that with her in a moment. But if you have questions or comments, do give us a call. We are eager to have listeners join the conversation. In Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If it's a long-distance call, use our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. Esther, when you decided to leave the city council, why did you do that?
why did I do that? Well, it's very demanding and very time consuming, and I had been on there for 11 years and 3 months, which was certainly long enough. You know, these aren't jobs for life. I think probably the most positive part about being on the city council was, you know, making a difference, passing laws that might not have been passed if I hadn't been there, and serving the people who I represented and being an information link between them and what government was doing. Definitely the most negative, the hardest part was the being on the job every waking moment, and I think this is probably it's funny how, you know, when people see their member of Congress or their state representative out in public, they just want to go shake their hand, and for some reason when they see their city council member, what they want to do is detain you and complain. and it really, you know, I'm talking 6 a.m. on New Year's Day when sure. I'm out walking
wearing. You
know, it definitely does get wearing.
There's joy, yes. But only for maybe 10 years.
Yeah, right. Though I would say, just as long as we're on this topic, on behalf of all current and future city council members, just remind the public that city council members have full-time jobs, not city council. And I would suggest never calling a city council member at their place of employment unless you have expressed permission to do so. Okay. That was really the single most stressful thing, was how much people try to take up my work time. And sure. My employer actually didn't pay me to do the city council job.
Sure, sure. We have a couple of callers waiting. Let's go to line number one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Esther Pat. Line number one.
Is this me?
Yes, it is.
I wanted to ask her, really, this is a difficult question, but do you think joy is a fragile thing? Thank you, friend. How personal.
Okay. How fragile a thing is joy? Is it something that that always just lasts a limited amount of time, I think our caller was asking about?
Well, that's sort of a kind of philosophical question.
Yeah.
I think joy is... can be passing and intermittent. I'm not sure quite where the caller was coming from, but I don't think it's possible to just do one thing, experience joy from it, and have that sustain you for the rest of your life. I think one has to keep seeking out or receiving opportunities for experiencing joy and the rewards of one's work.
Although I suspect that there were some things that you accomplished on the city council that will give you satisfaction for the rest of your life.
Yeah, I suppose that is true, yes.
We have another caller, this time on our toll-free line, line number four. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Yeah, I thought a few minutes ago you were really on to something about, I think, arguments against cynicism and maybe despair. And I really get a bout of it when I start thinking about our current governor, who I think, in my opinion, and the opinion of many people, no matter what party I know, but people that are very honest, think has acted extremely immature, childish, and may be facing an indictment with his friend Rezko. But anyway, it just seems like in Illinois, we are, you know, no matter how optimistic you try to be, we are under such a control of a governor and the leaders of the legislature just seem to be almost at impasse or act like little children, but they don't even want to get their act together. How does one overcome pessimism and despair and cynicism in the face of leadership, which just almost seems to just despair at any kind of even working out differences in a reasonable, civil way?
Although, frankly, for me, as far as despair about elected officials, the relief comes in elections. None of these people are there for life. I mean, I despair a lot more about the Supreme Court because, you know, if they're there, especially if I don't like the ones that are young, they're there for a long time. How do we get rid of them? But the governor, I mean, this isn't a solution for public policy concerns in the next year and a half, but in terms of feeling despair about the governor, there's another governor's race in 2010, and in some ways, I feel a longer term problem that just one election doesn't solve is the way leadership is handled in the House and in the Senate in Illinois.
Structural issues.
Yeah, I mean, just the amount of power that one person has in each of those two bodies. Although it is within the power of our state representatives and state senators to change the leadership. And I think that's really the key to try to breaking some of this up. I can't even tell you how long Mike Madigan has been speaker of the House, but it sure seems like it's been has it been 20 years? No, there was someone else in there, but he's been there a long time.
Caller, did you want to follow up?
How does that work, say, on the presidential level, ma'am? Do you
Oh. presidential level, we've got an election coming up, you know, this year.
I know. But, I mean, I guess I sort of sense I like Barack Obama, but I sense he's sort of being co-opted already. And I think I guess I get very frustrated when I think of what the Democrats promised in 2006 and how little progress has been made sort of toward ending the war in Iraq. But what is your thinking?
Well, I don't have a personal relationship with Barack Obama to be able to tell you what he would do, but I can't imagine, and I'm sure that there are thousands of listeners who agree with me on this, I can't imagine we won't see a change in what's happening in Iraq after the November election if Barack Obama is elected. I mean, that's the direction that we've been going with President Bush is so radically different from the direction Obama will take us in, even if he is not as left as some people on the left imagined he was or even saw him to be when he was younger. He is so different. I think we'll see on everything from the war to the economy to Supreme Court appointments a totally different kind of government. The difference to me is big enough that I'm really excited about the prospect of an Obama presidency. And I think, frankly, it will happen if people – you know, one thing that's really important about politics and all of this is that it's not like there's just one big force that moves things. Each of us as individuals are what make the force that moves things. And so if people want to see change, people have to work for change. It's not just going to happen by itself.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate the call. Thank you. This is a live call-in show, and listeners are encouraged to express their opinions. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana if it's a long-distance call, including if you're listening on the Internet through a computer somewhere, 1-800-222-9455. Esther, I mentioned that you were the coordinator of the University of Illinois Tenant Union. Tell us what that is.
The Tenant Union at the university is a student service that helps students when they rent any privately owned housing, and we deal with landlord-tenant problems, advise people, contact landlords on behalf of tenants and try to work out problems. And a big part of our focus is prevention. We review lease contracts with people before they sign them so they know what they are getting into and make suggestions for things they might want to change in the contract.
And that's a free service.
You know, it's a free service to students. That's right. And for anyone who's not a student in Champaign County, there is a Champaign-Urbana Tenant Union, which was actually created by the students who created Tenant Union 30-some years ago. And it basically duplicates the services of the Tenant Union at the university and provides those for everyone who's not a U of I student.
And how is that supported?
The Champaign-Urbana Tenant Union is funded by donations from people in the community.
Really?
Yes. And some of the donations are made through Community Shares of Illinois, which is one of the choices in workplace giving at public places of public employment like the U of I and Parkland College and the cities and the schools and also in some private workplaces.
We have another caller waiting with a comment or question on line number one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. This is kind of a pre-tenant question in terms of construction of buildings. It's become increasingly a bigger issue in Champaign-Urbana where when they're doing construction, they put up a cyclone fence that blocks in the sidewalk so you can have major streets. The most current one is at the corner of Lincoln and University, where there's no sidewalk, and these things can go on for months, and I just don't understand why this is allowed to happen for this period of time. I mean, for the most part, it seems it's there so construction people can have a place to park.
I don't have expertise in this area, but I don't think it's so that they can have a place to park. I'm thinking of what I thought you were going to say, because the one I notice all the time is on Green Street, where they're building
that's the massive one, too, yeah.
Yeah, and that's just held up traffic for so long, but if you're going to build a property, if you're going to build a building, you have to have some space around what will be, what's the footprint of the building for just, you know, for staging for the equipment. And I suppose that's why they do it. But as far as what the regulations are, that's, you know, what they could block off and how long and who they have to get the permissions from, that actually that would be the city governments if it's in Champaign or Urbana. So if I don't think the city would stop someone from building something because it interferes with traffic. I think they just reroute the traffic, and that's why so often when you walk around on campus too, there's so many signs that say sidewalk closed, and sometimes even roads are closed. I don't know of a way to prevent it.
But I mean, it gets to be that, you know, we're basically in third world country conditions at times. I mean, no sidewalks. I mean, it's just it's it gets to be a real danger, especially like in winter, and you have these things cut off, and people are walking in icy streets, and I just don't understand why provisions aren't made for pedestrians. If a sidewalk has a reason for being there in the first place, then I can't see the legitimacy for blocking it off for 6 months to 9 months at a time.
What would you suggest be done in order to be able to build a building right next to a sidewalk?
I mean, it doesn't take a very wide area to allow pedestrians through, that either, you know, make one lane of traffic or have them put the fence back enough so, you know, that a person could pass through, which is really not that wide at all.
Uh-huh. Well, I'll tell you, the place to direct that a comment, particularly if it's about a particular location, would be to your city council member or the mayor. Because they're the ones who make those kind of decisions.
Thank you for your call. Appreciate it. I know on campus it's particularly tight because of the way the university has expanded and the way the businesses have tried to get as close as possible, of course, to the university and all the students. And it's we had a problem with some tiles falling off the roof at the University of Hawaii where I'm the director, and we had to close off one sidewalk. But we got that repaired because it was of danger to people who are walking on that sidewalk, and often that's a construction issue too. But the city was very careful. This happened to be in Champaign, and the city was very careful to make sure that we put up the kind of barricades that indicated there's still a sidewalk on the other side of the street, cross here where it's safe, where there's a pedestrian crossway, and they tried to do that. Now, how successful they could be all the time, I don't know, but that seemed to work in our situation while we were able to then repair the slates on the roof so they were no longer of danger to pedestrians. That brings us, though, to a general question, I think. The whole issue of balancing of rights, individual rights, mm-hmm. group rights, construction rights, builders' rights. How does a public official make those kind of decisions?
Well, it is hard. I guess it to some extent, I mean, there are certain principles that guide things, and then a lot are case by case, and you just have to weigh the benefits and the downsides of each, and different people's opinions. And sometimes there's overwhelming support for one perspective over another, and a lot of times what's really hard is when it's just seems to be almost split down the middle, where half the people think one thing and half think the other, and you know, what do you do?
Well, let's talk about a specific example that's current in our towns. Since you're no longer on the city council, let's give you an easy one. What about free speech and hate speech?
An easy one. Yeah. That's, you know, the free speech, hate speech issue that came up recently in Urbana with Urbana Public Television and this more or less Nazi program reminded me so much of the whole controversy over the Nazis wanting to march in Skokie back in the late 70s. And though I was no longer living in the Chicago area at the time, the whole rest of my family, my parents and my brother and my sisters and my grandmother, who was still alive then, were all lived in Chicago, just a few miles from Skokie. And, you know, there, you know, we have the issues of people who feel so offended and really so personally attacked by the hate speech, because it is directed against them, that they want government to do something to stop it. And then we have the First Amendment to the Constitution, which is and has been in many other contexts very broadly interpreted to really protect the right of anyone to say anything in almost any context. I guess for me, that's a values question where there's just there is so much harm in allowing government to silence people for saying things that are unpopular that I quickly lean in favor of free speech and you know if you don't like what people are saying, counter them, picket them, speak out against them, don't listen to them, depending on the context of their speech, but that government should not ever have the power to say that something is so offensive that some idea is so offensive that an individual does not have the right to express that idea. I think that's one of the things that makes this country greatest is the fact that we do have free speech, and certainly if you're someone who has opinions that that you like to express and that other people find objectionable, that you don't think are offensive or objectionable, it might be easier to embrace the First Amendment as something so very valuable than people who I think some people can't imagine themselves being silenced, and so they don't worry as much about silencing others because they just don't see that could ever happen to them, so they just think, can't we just have reasonable standards and silence the people who say obnoxious things? But when something you believe strongly, which might even be your most passionate political concern or your own religious belief or whatever, is something that other people find offensive, then maybe you have a different perspective on the value of freedom of speech.
Now, in the interest of being totally open about this, we should admit that you are the current president of the local ACLU.
Yes. And it is because I have those feelings that I first joined the ACLU and that I've been so active that they made me president of the chapter.
And the American Civil Liberties Union has a history of defending people's right to speak even when they're pretty horrible people.
Right. Well, I think the most important cases are the ones that involve a client for the ACLU who's really on the extreme. The Klan and the Nazis have certainly been two of the organizations whose speech has been threatened and who have ended up being the clients in cases that the American Civil Liberties Union has brought. Although, as I always like to emphasize to people, like in the Nazi Skokie case, the client was the Nazis, but the their name was, I forget their name, but I think it was the National Socialist Party of Chicago or something. But the victory was the ACLU was defending the First Amendment. You know, was not defending the Nazis. American Civil Liberties Union, the people who actually handled the court case, didn't agree with anything the Nazis were saying. But that's really the point, is I don't have to agree with a single thing that you say to still understand the value of your right to say it, free from government interference. And the free from government interference is very important. While we're on the subject of American Civil Liberties Union, a lot of times when people feel that someone somewhere has infringed on some right, they say, well, you know, isn't that an ACLU issue? The American Civil Liberties Union is all about protecting our individual freedoms from government interference. So if somebody doesn't let you speak when you're a guest in their home, well, that's between you and them as you being a guest and their being your host. If the government doesn't let you speak, that's a civil liberties issue.
We have another caller, this time on our toll-free line, line number 4. Yes, go right ahead on Keeping the Faith.
Yeah. First of all, I think you have a lot of you're strong in being on the program, the guest. I'd like to say this hate speech, I believe that was created in order to suppress our speech. Because there's no such thing as, or a hate crime, I mean, hate crime or hate speech. And I disagree about the ACLU. They are, a lot of the time, they are not really protecting the citizens or all the citizens. But this hate speech and hate crime, who was that fellow that was a talk show host and minority group? I think it was Reverend, what's his name from New York?
Al Sharpton.
Sharpton. He had his. He had him be removed from his position. Well, Al Sharpton is on a program in Chicago. You should see that station, the things they say on that station. I'm not talking about Sharpton now on the radio, but that station. And so it is not the same for everyone. And also, the First Amendment was made for people who are in disagreement with something. That's why they have the First Amendment. And so this hate speech and hate crime is going really against the First Amendment. And I'd like to have your response on that, and I'll hang up.
Thank you for the call.
Well, I guess I'm not quite sure what you mean by saying that hate speech goes against the First Amendment. Generally, when people are talking about what people mean when they say hate speech is things people say that are inflammatory and derogatory toward individuals because of their race or gender or ethnicity or sexual orientation or something like that. And the First Amendment protects five freedoms, and the freedom of speech provided by the First Amendment to the Constitution is the right to say, you know, anything at all, and so which includes hateful things.
But the First Amendment, I think, mainly helps protect groups because individuals have the right to sue for libel, to sue for slander, whereas groups do not.
Well, but actually, the First Amendment does protect individuals. I mean, quite often, the people whose freedoms are abridged are, you know, individuals. A student is sent home from school because she's wearing a T-shirt that has interlocking women's symbols on it. And she says that's her free speech right, and the school says, well, they can control what people wear. In fact,
but in terms of hate speech, I was referring.
Hate speech.
Or then it's really defense of groups, I think.
Well, no, actually, there have been a number of cases that have been there were some cases where people were if you go back 30, 40 years where people were arrested. I mean, an individual person was arrested for making a speech that found to be offensive and violated some city ordinance or even some state law. So as far as the hate speech, I guess where a group is more the target of hate speech. But as far as who's making the speech, it's protecting the right of the individual,
yeah.
And it could be an individual or it could be a group making that speech. Though there is a difference between hate speech and hate crime. So there are people who disagree about this. If someone commits a crime, the crime is the wrongful act. And if some laws that are hate crime laws are about punishing more severely a person who commits battery or a person who commits murder or for reasons having to do with hate. And that's very different than hate speech, in which no crime has been committed. The offense is just the speech itself, and that's where people like me and the American Civil Liberties Union feel strongly that the speech is protected.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, even libel. We all say, I mean, I've said too that, well, you know, there's an exception. You know, libel is the exception to free speech. But it really, I don't think that's really, and I'm not a lawyer, but I don't think that's really an accurate way to describe it. It's not really that there's an exception for libel. It's if you do harm to another person and you have caused them to suffer a loss and they can prove that they suffered a loss because of the harm you did, and that the harm came from something you said, And this is not true in other countries, but in the United States, the person has to prove, the person who's claiming damages because of something someone said about them has to prove that what was said about them was untrue, that the person, the speaker who said it, knew it was untrue and said it for malicious reasons for the purpose of causing harm. And then that harm has to be proven. It can't just be my feelings are hurt. So it's a pretty strict standard. Unlike
very narrow. Yeah.
Yes, in other countries, in the United Kingdom and Canada, I believe that in a case of libel, that the person who's if you sue an author for saying something wrong about you, they have to prove it's true. Whereas in the United States, you would have to prove what they said about you in the book was not true.
I see. Well, what I said earlier was wrong. I did misspeak, but that clarifies it. Thank you very much. And we have another caller on line number four. Yes, go ahead.
Yes, this is the same party. Regarding hate crime, a crime is a crime is a crime. If it's a crime, you take it to court and find out what the reason was for the person that committed the crime. And so then the judge determines what the sentence should be. Things are never made specific. What is a hate speech and what is a hate crime? Except for minorities. And I don't know what minorities they're talking about.
Okay, I'll give you an example on hate crime. Although I will say that there are some, I know there are some members of our local steering committee who feel that hate crime is a horrible thing, but if the whole basis of distinguishing
a crime is a horrible thing,
right? Exactly. That if someone beats someone up, beating them up is the crime, and that we shouldn't be factoring in what the person who did the attacker said when they were doing the beating up.
But if someone were to attack me and commit a crime, and I am a white person. So that shouldn't be so bad, you know. But if I'm a black person, oh, this is horrendous. Or if this is a Jewish person, oh, this is worse. It's a worse crime. It's not a worse crime. If you're attacking me, or if I'm attacking you, it's still the same crime.
The fact that the person's race or religion or whatever in and of itself does not make a crime a hate crime. I think the idea behind it is that if a group of people...
I understand what it means.
Okay.
The thing is, the judge determines what the situation is and what the crime, what the sentence should be, because you can't specify. If you specify exactly what a hate crime is, what a hate speech is, and exactly who a terrorist is, then you say those specific things, then I might have something to agree with.
Well, thank you very much. Any response?
Yeah, let me give. These might not be right on point analogies, but like. Sexual assault is a crime. If a weapon is used, if the victim is under the age of 16, if the victim was tied up by the perpetrator, that's aggravated criminal sexual assault. And laws are many different kinds of laws like that are structured in that way so that there are aggravating circumstances that make what is a crime a more serious crime or a crime that is punishable by a greater sentence. And so
there are differences of opinion about how far that should go.
Right, right. Sure. And so that's kind of where I think where the whole subject of hate crimes comes in is that if you beat someone up, that's a crime. If you beat someone up because that person is gay for the purpose of terrorizing other gay people, that's
another
a heavier
crime.
Sentence. Yeah, yeah, right.
Right. Well, we're talking with Esther Pat, who for 11 years was on the Urbana City Council, and she did not run again after 2005. We're talking with her about social ethics and politics and what pleasures, satisfactions come from joining in this citizen process in this country. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs, and I'm the director of the University YMCA, which provides support for this program on WILL. One of the programs at the University of Illinois Y this summer is a children's rummage sale. And this Friday, not this Friday, but Friday, July 18 and Saturday, July 19, we'll be having a rummage sale at the Y at the corner of Chalmers and Wright Street. It'll start at 7 o'clock on Friday morning and go to 1 o'clock, and on Saturday starting at 8 o'clock and going to noon. And all the proceeds go to benefit the University Y. And these are gently used children's clothes and toys and furniture and books and a lot more. If you're interested, do come by the Y. If you want more information, call us at 337-1500. And remember, our big dump-and-run sale happens at the Stock Pavilion starting August 23rd, 24th, and 25th. So we'll have all kinds of things, furniture and clothes and computers and who knows what all, filling the Stock Pavilion again for that big sale starting August 23rd. But the children's sale is at the University YMCA on Wright Street. And that starts Friday, July 18 at 7 in the morning. Well, let's get back to talking with Esther Patt, who's our guest today. I might mention that next week on Keeping the Faith, we'll be not accepting phone calls because our program has been pre-recorded. We'll be talking with a Hindu Swami who was here about a month ago to help start off the kickoff for the new Hindu temple that's being that will be being built here in Champaign. So, Esther, let's talk a little bit more about some of your particular interests. I know one of the things that's a big issue in Urbana right now is the whole issue of the instant runoff voting. Tell us your thoughts on that issue.
Well, instant runoff is something that some people around the country are working on because they think it will improve the way we conduct elections. And actually, the particular controversy that's going to be decided tomorrow night at 6 o'clock in the City Building in Urbana is whether to put a question on the ballot to have instant runoff for local elections. And I personally am of the opinion that we should be having public dialogue first before we put questions on the ballot. And there are other people who want to put the question on the ballot first. And it's been a pretty heated. Instant runoff is a method of voting whereby the voter does not just go in and vote for one candidate but ranks all the candidates running for a particular office. So if there were four people running for mayor, you would vote for your first choice and then you would rank the other candidates second, third, and fourth choice. And then the way votes would be tabulated would be that whoever is the fourth place candidate, their ballots would be recounted looking at who did those voters choose as their second choice. And then those would be distributed among the other three candidates. And of course, some people wouldn't rank, so that knocks it out. And then there would be people who would – and then the voting machine would go to the candidate who's in third place at that point, which might not be the same one who was third place the first time, and divide those votes up among the other candidates. And then you get into an interesting twist where some people voted first choice for the third place candidate and second choice for the fourth place and vice versa. So on those, they'd be going to their third choice. And it's all supposed to end up with somebody after you do all this, the machine does all this recounting, ends up being the candidate with the most votes who presumably has more than 50% of the vote. The advocates of instant runoff says this guarantees that whoever wins the election really has majority support, but actually it doesn't because not all people do the ranking, and so you could end up with the candidate who gets the most votes on the initial as far as first choice doesn't win the election, that the election is actually won by someone who did not get the most votes, and that person who won did not get 51% of the vote either, but after counting the second and third choices of some of the other voters, that person pushed ahead of the first place one, which is part of why I'm against it. And as I've been saying when I explained it to people, if my explanation to you just now was confusing, then I have proven my point, because it is confusing. And that's one of the people who are opposed to instant runoff are opposed because it's confusing and because it's fundamentally unfair to have an election where the candidate who gets the most votes could lose. People who support
the most
it.
The first-place votes.
Yeah, right, the most first-place votes. And then you could even have, and you know, if the people who support it have been, or, I mean, locally, and I think this is probably true in other parts of the country, have been pushing the idea of, and this is what it's all about, is that when you have three candidates running and you like two of them, like Gore, Nader, Bush, you want to vote for Nader, but you know he's not going to win, so can you vote for Nader and basically have it not count because you can pick Gore is your second choice, and then Gore will beat Bush. But the only thing is that all elections don't involve three candidates and you like two of them. If there were three candidates and you only liked one, and that one got 47% of the vote but then lost the election because of instant runoff, I don't know that people would be so thrilled with it. And if you ever have more than three candidates, it just gets downright confusing. In San Francisco, they used instant runoff for their municipal elections in 2007, and voter turnout dropped from 54% in 2003 mayoral race to only 35 or 36% in the 2007. And there was I was quoted in the paper saying something about this last week or 2 weeks ago, and a woman from North Carolina emailed me a whole bunch of stuff from North Carolina where they're fighting this because they had a few cities where they used instant runoff for their local elections. And in one of the cities, more than a third of the people did not rank the candidates, do their first, second, third, fourth choice, because they didn't understand it. And that's a real concern, that it's that it is confusing to voters. My personal experience, having worked in elections from everything from president down to city council, for over 30 years, is keep it simple. Anything that makes it simpler and clearer and easier for the voter is good, and anything that makes it more complicated is bad. And I remember, I don't know if you remember, when we used to have cumulative voting for state representatives, but I found the first time I voted using cumulative voting, I didn't find it confusing. I knew what I was doing, but the next election, when I went out door to door for the elections and had to talk to other people about cumulative voting, I found all sorts of people extremely confused about it. And then when they voted in Champaign City Council at large elections where we didn't have cumulative voting, but you vote for three candidates, people got confused about that because they thought cumulative voting applied there when it only applied for state rep. So I think it's not a good idea. And I've been encouraging people who do not think we should be putting instant runoff on the ballot for November to show up tomorrow night at 6 o'clock at the City Building in Urbana to vote no. And I know there are people working hard to turn people out to get them to show up to vote yes. And whether it's on the ballot will actually be decided tomorrow night. And if it is on the ballot, then a lot of people who could be working on what I think are much more important things, like the township referendum in Champaign to increase the levy to serve the poor and saving the nursing home, are instead going to be working on instant runoff, which I think is a diversion and something that if there really are enough people interested in it, should be studied more, along with other ways of voting. It's not like the only choices are what we do now or instant runoff before it's just thrown on the ballot to give us one more thing to focus on in November.
We're down to our last 10 minutes of Keeping the Faith with our guest, Esther Patt. We're talking about social ethics and politics. Give us a call, 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. We do ask you to keep your comments short so we can get more people on the air who'd like to be. Let's talk a little bit about another of your concerns, affordable housing.
Yeah, affordable housing. You know, it's just amazing to me how much discussion there is about the cause of homelessness in this country and how many people just don't seem to make the connection that homelessness is caused by lack of affordable housing. And they try to find what socio-psychological problems lead people to become homeless, as though anyone who are homeless, I mean, with the exception of a few people, you wouldn't be if only you could somehow social service them out of it. And the problem is that rent's too high for a whole lot of people. And most affordable housing dollars are in this country, you know, federal and state, are spent on creating housing that people with income below the poverty level cannot afford. And I think a lot of folks don't realize that too. They say, well, you know, what, like even. Well, I don't want to name one program. I don't want to name one. But there are many good agencies here in this town who work on affordable housing programs. But people who make less than $15,000 a year can't afford the housing that they're creating. And then the Department of Housing and Urban Development defines low income as a household with income below 80% of area median family income. So there are all sorts of programs that target dollars to families who make, say, $40,000 a year. And $40,000 a year certainly is not rich, but if you're a single parent raising two children on a minimum wage job, if you're lucky to get the 40 hours a week, which most minimum wage workers don't get,
right,
your gross income in Illinois, where we have a higher minimum wage, is $15,600. Now, using the Housing and Urban Development Department standard that a household should not spend more than 30% of their income on rent and utilities, if you make $15,600 a year, that's your 30% comes out to $390 a month for rent and utilities. Now, I challenge you, and this is something, I guess part of the reason I feel so strongly about this is all these years working at the tenant union, I'm constantly looking for at housing listings and the classified sections of the Gazette and the Daily Illini. I know how much rent costs. And $390 a month plus utilities, you can get an efficiency apartment, which is not big enough for a mother with two children. And even the housing that is there's some tax credit places, you know, places like Town Center and Rainbow Apartments and Prairie Green. And now the replacement housing for the public housing, the rents there are, to afford a two-bedroom apartment there, you need to make $26,000 a year. So all the people with income below the poverty level, and actually even with people with income above the poverty level whose income isn't at least – all right, people will really spend more than 30% of their income, but say at least $23,000, $24,000 a year cannot afford any housing out there. There are some subsidized housing programs like the Section 8 voucher program and the tiny bit of public housing that's left. But if you add up all the programs – that subsidize rent for households with income below the poverty level, and you compare it just in Champaign County to the number of families with income below the poverty level, about 19% of the need is being met. So 81% of households, you know, whether they're families with children or senior citizens with income below the poverty level, get no assistance for paying their rent, and there's no rent out there that they actually can afford. So we definitely need more government dollars to subsidize rent for housing for the poorest of the poor. And that has been politically has been such a tremendous just such a struggle. And it's something – I mean, I just feel like we're losing ground all the time. Even when I was on the Urbana City Council, and Urbana is so liberal, there was really never majority support for making that a priority, and it isn't a priority there now either, you know, or in Champaign. Tearing down public housing and eliminating what little housing we have available for the poor is the priority, and it's being replaced with housing that the people who lived in it cannot afford.
At what level of government should there be support for affordable housing?
Federal, state, and local.
All levels.
Yes. And actually, what frustrates me so much, and I don't begrudge assistance to people who make $40,000 a year, and I, it's not that I don't care about people who have to rent because they can't afford to buy their own house. Helping them buy their own home is great, but federal, state, and local governments do spend, you know, combined millions and actually billions on affordable housing programs, but the money is so much more targeted toward higher income people, which in terms of your dollars, I suppose it makes sense. If I have $50,000, I can help a lot more families with income over $50,000 a year with my $50,000 than the number of families I could help whose income is below $15,000. But who needs it the most? And I think the highest priority should be the people who whose income is lowest.
As you look back on your career as 11 years on the city council, are there any things you regret? Any things you wish had happened differently? That you've done differently?
Oh, I suppose there are a lot of things that I would have liked to have done differently, though. I don't know if it would have, made a difference. I mean, there are some things. I think about some of the decisions, like the whole Lincoln Mobile Home Park. There was a mobile home park that was closed, and to have apartment complex put up in place. And you know, in some ways, I always think of that as that was really the most positive and the most negative of all the experiences I had when I was on city council. The positive was that 85% of the families who were displaced would have gotten less than what they got in terms of relocation assistance, and would have been in worse circumstance if one other council member, Mari Orion, and I had not fought so hard for relocation assistance. But of course, the negative was that all the people really got a bum deal, every one of them. And the fact that 85% of them did get more than they would have had we not been there is not, I'm sure it wasn't consolation to them when they were in their bad circumstance. And I guess I think of things more in terms of that. You know, the same thing with Lakeside Terrace demolition. You know, I mean, I was really against demolishing Lakeside Terrace unless the city had a plan for replacing all of the units with equally affordable housing. We ended up going for a compromise, and the compromise turned out to be a ruse, and we didn't even get that. So, you know, it's things like that.
Wow. And in our last 30 seconds, what are you proudest of?
What am I proudest of?
That you were able to accomplish.
It's hard to pick just one thing. Okay. I think just being part of things like, you know, getting bus service extended to nights and weekends. That was 30-some years ago, but that was one of the most fun campaigns that I ever worked on. And I think probably just in general, you know, for people listening, what I'm most proud of is trying to make a difference and sometimes succeeding.
Uh-huh. Our guest today on Keeping the Faith has been Esther Patt, who is the coordinator of the University of Illinois Tenant Union and current president of the Champaign-Urbana ACLU. We've been talking about the joy of social ethics and politics. Thanks to Esther and our callers for the issues they raised. Next week on Keeping the Faith, we'll be talking with a Hindu Swami about the Hindu temple that's being planned for construction here in Champaign-Urbana. On July 13, our guest is a historian from Millikan University, Bill Kegel. We'll be talking about the important issue, why do we suffer? Dennis Dooling, a biblical scholar at Canisius College in New York, will be our guest on July 20. The Gospel of Matthew is the topic. Life as a hospital chaplain will be our topic for July 27th, and our guest will be the Mennonite pastor, Peter Dick. Mark Johnson, national president of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, will be our guest on August 3rd. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the director of the University YMCA for another month or two. I'm happy to announce that Willard Broom will be the interim director. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Men are under siege. They might be the stronger sex, but as far as cultural clout goes, they get the short end of the stick. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, why one writer says the feminist movement lost its way and ended up making men the enemy. Is it time to save the males? It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 on WILL Urbana.
At one time, Ivory Coast was the most stable country in West Africa. Then, in 2002, a civil war split the country. In March 2007, the government, which had held the South, signed a peace deal with rebels in control of the North. The hope is this will finally bring an end to 5 years of war. Monday on Focus 580, we'll talk about recent events in Ivory Coast with two guests, both from the University of Illinois, Tom Bassett, professor of geography, and Carol Spindell, adjunct lecturer in the English department. I'm David Inge, Focus 580, Monday at 11, here on WILL Urbana.
To Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Bates Commodities Incorporated, Normal; Michael W. Walker Consulting, Urbana; Ray's Heating and Air Conditioning, Urbana; and First Federal Savings Bank, Champaign-Urbana. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
Tim was an always